What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
What's stopping
you? I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you?
You.
This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. It is the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. Those of you who have questions about the Catholic faith, by golly, this is your chance to get those questions answered. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also send us an email. We would love to get your email at ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Aquiles, our producer, Matt Kabinski handling the phone screening. Ace McKay is looking at social media, specifically YouTube and Facebook. So if you want to ask a question on one of those platforms, we're streaming there live right now. Look, I'm waving at you. All you have to do is put in your question in the chat screen, and then Ace will see that, and he'll send it to us here in the studio. That's how it works. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I am well. Are you staying warm, my friend?
Well, you know, like, as of right this very second, Alabama's not particularly cold right now.
Not particularly.
It's going to be tomorrow, however.
Says here 50. We're having 50-degree weather today.
Yeah, well, that's
pretty okay.
You know, when I lived in Illinois in the wintertime, when it rose to 32, that's when you put on your shorts and T-shirt and went out and played tennis.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Absolutely. So in just a second, we're going to get to the phones, but right now we're going to lead off with a question we received overnight on the EWTN listener comment line.
Yes, this is Pasita Gelasio, and I want to ask David, or Dr. David, about church. I want to know where in the Bible say that we need to go to church. Thank you.
Yeah.
God bless.
Thank you. I really appreciate the question. So the word church, the English word church, is a translation of the Greek word ecclesia, which means assembly or gathering.
Uh-huh.
And Christ uses that word in the Gospels, in particular with St. Peter. He says, you're Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. The gates of hell will not prevail against mm-hmm. it. Gives Peter and the other apostles a commission to make disciples and teach everything that he's commanded and to baptize them. So we have the formation of this community. We have at least some of its constitutive rights, like teaching and baptism, for the purpose of disciple building. In the institution narratives in the Gospels, where Christ institutes the sacraments, he gives the command, do this in memory of me. Now, in the Gospels themselves, there's no reference to the context or frequency, but we do get that in the epistles of the New Testament. And so St. Paul gives us a lengthy description of the Eucharistic liturgy in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and explains that the church comes together to participate in the sacrifice of Christ, and therefore they ought to recognize the Lord's body in the consecrated elements as well as mystically in one another and live in harmony together. The book of Hebrews exhorts us not to neglect the assembling of ourselves together. And the book of Acts demonstrates that this early Christian community gathered routinely on the first day of the week, that's the day that Christ rose from the dead, to celebrate his resurrection through, the language of the text is, the breaking of bread, the apostles' teaching, and prayers. And the breaking of bread is euphemistically a reference to the Eucharist. So it's pretty well embedded in the text of the New Testament. That being said, there is in your question, perhaps, an unassumed premise. Where in the Bible does it teach? Now, I think I've given you a case that the Bible definitely talks about going to church. But the question, where in the Bible does it teach, sometimes makes me think that we might have the idea in the back of our heads that if something's not in the Bible, then that means we're somehow not obligated to it as Christians. And that's a problematic notion, because the Bible wasn't given to us to be a comprehensive repository of everything you need to know or do as a Christian. Protestants think that. But the Bible itself doesn't say that about itself. And in fact, Christ gives a different criterion for knowing the content of the Christian faith. He says to the apostles, whoever hears you hears me. Whoever rejects you rejects me. And so our criterion for Christian truth is actually the teaching of the apostles and their successors, which is not restricted to the contents of the Bible, but also includes sacred tradition and the living magisterium of the church. So even if I didn't have a Bible, if the bishop said, oh, let's all go to Mass on Sunday, I would know that I was supposed to go to Mass on Sunday.
Sure.
Because my bishop, who is a successor of the apostles, said so.
There you go. Thank you so much for your question that we received overnight on the EWTN listener comment line, which is a different phone number than the one that you need to call right now, 833-288-EWTN. We are live on this Friday afternoon, 833-288-3986. David, when I read this next email that we received from Kevin, your headphones may not fit anymore.
Okay, let's
because
hear.
It's rather optimistic. Kevin says, the call to communion programs are normally excellent. On occasion, they're exceptional. That is the case with the program today, Wednesday, the 26th, which was 2 days ago. He says, exceptional. Excellent questions, exceptional answers. God bless you. Thanks, Kevin.
Well, that's really nice, Kevin. You've neglected to mention that sometimes they're lousy, too. You know, I mean, every once in a while, we'll, before the show, Tom and I are kind of shooting the bull, and he'll say, how you doing today? And I'll be like, ugh. Serious major headache today. And then I get off the air and my wife says, what'd you talk about today? And I'm like, I have no idea. Serious major headache today. So, you know, in the providence of God, we have good days, we have bad days, and we're grateful for everything in between.
Well, but the cool thing is that when you're actually doing the show, we don't hear any of that. We hear optimism for the faith. We hear joy in your heart.
Well, you know, every once in a while, somebody will answer a question and say, Anders, can you tell me, you know, blah, 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 and I'll be like, yes. That's usually a headache day.
That does not help me.
Right, exactly.
Thanks again, Kevin, for your very kind comments. If you'd like to send us an email for a future show, here's the address, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. All right, phone lines are wide open. We have six lines coming into the studios here, and they're all six open. So this is your chance to get in. Maybe there's a question that's been nagging at you, and you're thinking, you know, maybe those guys on the radio can answer it. I'll bet we can. I bet he can. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. It is the Friday edition of Call to Communion. We're live here on EWTN. Do stay with us. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. We're live on this Friday afternoon, 833-288-EWTN is the number to call, 833-288-3986. We'll get to it in just a moment. Matt is screening the calls even as we speak, but there's still room for you, 833-288-EWTN. You may have heard that we are expanding our mission on YouTube with brand new channels made just for you. Visit our main YouTube channel to explore the new navigation bar. Subscribe to the channels that speak to your heart. Hint, hint, like the radio channel. Wherever you are on your journey of faith, there is an EWTN channel for you. Do check out what we've done on the YouTube platform. Got a whole team of people working very, very hard to make it as user-friendly as possible, which is really what it's all about. If you can get there, as they say, if you can get there in one click instead of 10 clicks, so much the better. And that's what we're trying to do. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Let us begin with Barbara, a first-time caller from Dallas, listening on the Great Guadalupe Radio, AM 910. Hey there, Barbara. What's on your mind today?
Yes, I've been going to this local Catholic church for many years, and we have a wonderful bishop that is our priest, and my granddaughter had her communion there, and when she wanted to get her confirmation at a larger church, they wouldn't accept her communion because they said the church we're going to is old Catholic, and I don't know what that means.
Yeah, I can help you. I really appreciate the question. So, at the First Vatican Council, 19th century ecumenical council of the Catholic Church, the church promulgated the dogma of papal infallibility. There were some people at the council and some people in the Catholic world at the time who dissented from that dogma. They disagreed with the council's decision, and they rejected it. Well, the church's position is that if the church defines something as a dogma and you reject it, that's technically the definition of heresy, right? And so that group of people separated themselves from the Catholic Church. Now, in their own mind, their position is, no, we're maintaining the faith that we've already have it. We see papal infallibility as an innovation, so we're rejecting this new thing. We're sticking with what we thought we knew before. We're the real Catholic Church. And so they referred to themselves as the old Catholic Church. But they are effectively a different religious organization. They're kind of like, you know, a Protestant denomination, in a manner of speaking. There are major differences from other Protestants, of course. But insofar as they are a group that's broken away from Catholic unity to define their own dogmas and their own hierarchy and their own system, they're separate from the Catholic Church. But the trappings of Catholicism are very similar. You know, the liturgy is very similar. In theory, the old Catholic Church can maintain valid sacraments, except I believe, and I haven't ever been to one and I'm not that familiar, but I believe they permit women's ordination. And so any putative sacraments that require the presence of a priest performed by a minister of the old Catholic Church who's female would de facto be invalid because she wouldn't be validly ordained. And I don't know if they have female bishops or not. I'm not sure if they claimed to or not. But if they did, anyone that person reportedly ordained would also be invalidly ordained because that person wouldn't be validly a bishop. Anyway, that's the old Catholic Church. Now, if someone's baptized in the old Catholic Church, provided they use the Trinitarian formula and intend to do what the church means by baptism, that baptism is presumptively valid. And again, just because a group is in schism from the Catholic Church doesn't mean that they can't possess valid ordination and valid apostolic succession. I'm not exactly sure what the case is right now with in terms of old Catholicism. So it is possible that there could be a valid mass in there someplace. And again, I'm not up on the Holy See's determinations on this, so I can't answer that. But as far as First Communion is concerned, even if a mass were valid, you know, if that mass is not celebrated in communion with the Catholic Church, it wouldn't be communion with the Catholic Church. You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
But that itself shouldn't be a barrier to confirmation insofar as, you know, like I myself am a convert to the Catholic Church. I did not grow up in the Catholic Church, old Catholic or otherwise. I grew up Presbyterian, was validly baptized in the Presbyterian Church. I received the sacrament of confirmation before I ever received Holy Communion. Right. And so, you know, it's not necessary to have literally communed prior to receiving the valid sacrament of confirmation. But, you know, if they want your daughter to go through a First Communion rite at her local Catholic parish in order to receive confirmation, you know, I wouldn't quibble. I would just do that and get on board with whatever the pastor says and get back in communion with the Pope.
Sure.
Is that helpful for you, Barbara?
It is. A little confusing, but it is helpful.
Basically, the long and the short of it is the old Catholic Church is not the Catholic Church.
To be exactly the same as it always has been, but...
Nope, it's not exactly the same at all because they're not in communion with the Pope. It's not in any respect the same.
That is the biggest problem,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, so the big kahuna here is the old Catholic Church is not Catholic because they're not in communion with the Pope. Whatever else they may have in common... The fact that they're not in communion with the Pope means they are not Catholic.
Barbara, thanks so much for your call. I hope that's helpful for you. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. Three lines open at 833-288-EWTN. Again, it is the Friday afternoon edition of Call to Communion. Glad that you are with us. Let's stay in Dallas and talk with Matt, also listening on the Great Guadalupe Radio. Hello, Matt. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hello, Dr. Anders. I had an old Protestant friend meet me and challenge my newfound Catholic faith. And he raised two questions that I could not answer. The first is in Romans 10:6-7, we are urged not to say who will send up or who will go down. And even priests during funerals will not say, hey, we know brother Joe is in heaven right now in a better place. So he turned the tables on me and said, if that is true, how is it, and this is the first part, how is it that the church can declare someone a saint who is in heaven? And number two, he said, why do you even say saints are in heaven? Because in the Bible, saints are only mentioned on earth, and saint means to sanctify. And then once we're in heaven, we do not need further sanctification. At this point, I'll hang up and listen to your response.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So first of all, let's go to Romans 10, the passage about not ascending or descending. Moses writes this about the righteousness that is by the law. The person who does these things will live by them. But the righteousness that is by faith says, do not say in your heart, who will ascend into heaven? That is, to bring Christ down. Or who will descend into the deep? That is, to bring Christ up from the dead. So this is not a passage that has anything to do whatsoever at all with the question of the souls of the righteous dead. This is a question about Christology and about the ascension of Christ to the right hand and of our mode of access to him. So to apply this to the question of canonization is just a gross category mistake, right? It just is, okay?
Okay.
Now, with respect to the business of sanctification, hagios in Greek, sanctus in Latin, saint in English, mean holy. In Isaiah, when he sees the Lord high and seated on a throne, he says, the seraphim and angels in heaven declare, kadosh, 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 which is Hebrew for holy, 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 or separate, separate, separate. That's the same word translated in Latin as sanctus, 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 which is actually part of the Mass, right? Well, by your friend's argument, we shouldn't possibly ever say that God is holy because he's not in need of sanctification. And yet, Scripture hails God magnificently as sanctus, sanctus, sanctus. Hagios, 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 right?
Yeah.
And so I think that argument is grossly inaccurate. And there's a conceptual mistake here, the distinction between the act of being made holy and the state of holiness. Now, Scripture uses the word hagios or sanctification or sanctified in a couple different senses. One sense is that when a person is baptized, one is set apart for a special purpose. One is set apart from the mass of humanity and adopted into God's family and given a special dignity as a child of God, which remains even if one is sinful. And thus St. Paul can say in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, don't go in for prostitution, because if you do, you will unite the body of Christ with a prostitute. Well, clearly, that's not a very holy thing to do. And yet Paul recognizes there's a kind of holiness, that is to say, a set-apartness. That's what the word holy means, or sanctus, or hagios, or kadosh. That Christians are set apart for a holy purpose, thus saints in that sense, even if they fail to live up to that purpose. There's another sense in which we can talk about holiness and sanctification. When the Bible exhorts us to live a holy life, that is to say, what Pope Gregory the Great once exhorted, Christian, become what you are. Actually live in accord with the dignity that has been conferred on you that you might be called a child of God, right? And that dignity is actually what is required to inherit eternal life. As is evidenced many places in Scripture, not least of which is Matthew 25, where Jesus says, you ain't getting into heaven just because you say, Lord, Lord, but rather because of your moral behavior. In fact, every passage of Scripture that addresses the question of future glory makes it contingent upon our moral behavior, justification by works. There's sure. No other frame of reference in Scripture for being declared worthy of heaven other than a judgment by our works. Revelation chapter 20, Romans chapter 1, Matthew chapter 25 all do this. So the only question left to ask is, well, we know that you have to actually be morally sanctified. We know that people in heaven, including the person of God, can with justice be declared holy because God is declared holy. The only other question we have is, are there conscious human beings in the presence of God now? Okay. Now, the account of the Transfiguration is pretty strong evidence from Scripture that the dead can at least appear to the living on occasion as conscious. And they're not just doppelgangers. They're not just, you know, daguerreotypes of Elijah and Moses. They're actually Elijah and Moses.
Daguerreotypes.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Great word.
Yeah, they're the actual, they're the real McCoy.
The real right? deal, the yeah, yeah.
And there they are, communing with Christ. So there's at least two people who can have conscious existence after death in the presence of Jesus. St. Paul, Book of Philippians, expresses his expectation that he would rather depart and be with the Lord, hence his possibility of getting there, although he recognizes that'll be dependent upon God's judgment. Because I don't judge myself, it's the Lord who judges me, right? And I press on lest I not be declared unworthy after having myself preached to others. Book of Revelation specifically references these elders gathered around the throne of the Lamb in glory, who proclaim the glories of God, worship Him as holy, and offer up the prayers of the saints, the prayers of the church on earth. So there's a pretty robust biblical picture, both of conscious existence after death, of the suitability of referring to individuals as holy in more than one sense. So, I think here of a gross category mistake in the interpretation of Romans 10.
Appreciate your phone call. There's time for your phone call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Let's go to Tara now. Tara is in Missouri, listening on the Great Catholic Radio Network. Hey, Tara, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hey, good afternoon. Say, reading today, there's Matthew 12:43-45, where Jesus talks about the unclean spirit that goes out, and when he comes back, everything is nice and clean. And so he brings in seven other spirits, and it says, and the last condition of that person is worse than the first. So, golly, I mean, it sounds like every time Jesus drove out demons, did he actually make the people worse as a result? I mean, what's the interpretation of that? Because that certainly can't be true.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So I would not at all interpret that text as having anything to do necessarily with exorcism, although it could, and I'll give you an instance. In early Christian demonology, it was widely believed and taught, and actually there was spirituality based on this, particularly in the Desert Fathers, and I'm thinking of somebody like Evagrius Ponticus, and in St. Paul's letters too, for that matter, that demonic forces are influences in human cognition, even for the saints, even for the holy, even for the monastic, and that they are, you know, pressing in on human consciousness to tempt us, and there are, you know, techniques one should use to deal with that and to resist a demonic temptation. But there's no suggestion that those demons are somehow permanently attached to the consciousness, like that one particular demon latches onto you like a guardian angel, only it's inverse,
yeah,
and always stays there.
Yeah.
I think it's better to understood in this context is, you know, imagine somebody who falls under sort of the sway of a particularly strong impulse that might be demonic, and then they get a respite from it. And they become sort of lackadaisical and careless.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're like, I got that pride thing beat. I got that lust thing beat, you know. And what we know from just empirical experience is that, say, in the life of addiction, for example, is that it is a consistent spiral downward. You don't plateau.
No.
You just get worse.
Sure. And if you think you're getting better, well, you know what SpongeBob says.
You quit. Or you get worse.
Exactly. Thanks, Tara, for your call. Lots more straight ahead here on Call to Communion. Glad you're with us for the Friday edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN. One line open, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Let's get to Ryan, a first-time caller in Fargo, listening on the great Real Presence Radio. Hey, Ryan, what's on your mind today?
Hi, guys. Thanks so much for taking my call. I have a friend, a coworker, who is, she joined a Catholic book group and is reading really great books, but she's Missouri Synod Lutheran. And what I'm trying to do is figure out more about the her specific denomination and, like, how I can help her cross the Tiber. So I'll hang up and listen to your advice.
Okay.
Oh, wow. Yeah. How about that? Yeah. So in terms of learning more about her specific denomination, I mean, you could begin by reading the foundational doctrinal statements of Lutheranism. You get a hold of the Book of Concord, and you could read Luther's catechisms and the Augsburg Confession and the Apology for the Augsburg Confession by Philip Melanchthon, and, you know, get the dogmatic structure of Lutheranism in your head to understand and appreciate it. You could read some biographies of Luther, some histories of early Lutheranism, that sort of thing. You know, in terms of, you know, how do you help that person cross the Tiber? Well, the first question I would have is, does that individual want to cross the Tiber? You know, I mean, it's pretty hard to detach somebody from a system of belief and practice in a community that they're deeply embedded in just through argumentation. Right, because most of us are fairly inured to even good arguments if we don't like the conclusions. You know, there's a kind of willful ignorance that we can exhibit, all of us. I mean, Catholics as well as Lutherans, where you know, don't bother me with the truth, kind of thing. You know, I mean, I'm not interested in that. And of course, that's not the way they conceptualize it. It's, you know, Newman said that people assent to arguments primarily because, not because they're deductively proven to be true, but because they sort of confirm what our basic intuitions are about reality. And so, you know, a person can get interested in Catholicism because of its beauty, because of its antiquity, because of the holiness of the saints. And all those factors are, they're not irrational factors, but they're not like logical syllogisms. You know, they appeal to the immoral imagination, they appeal to our moral intuitions, these kinds of things. Uh-huh. And then arguments come by after the fact and kind of shore up, you know, hard and fast, what we are kind of already hoping is true. You know, St. Thomas says in the Summa that you know, men love a doctrine, and then they go looking for arguments to support it, right? So apologetics is primarily for people who are, Tom uses this expression all the time, in receive mode.
Yeah.
People who are disposed to believe and just want to make sure their intellect doesn't get in the way, right? And so the first and most important thing when sharing your life and faith with somebody who's not Catholic is just to make sure that you appeal to all those sort of pre-rational, I didn't say irrational or non-rational, but those sort of pre-rational considerations to build that base of friendship and trust and communion, to live the faith as good, true, and beautiful so that you're manifesting it. Jesus tells us to be lights. One place Christ says, you know, let your good deeds shine before men so they can see them and glorify your Father who's in heaven. He doesn't say let your brilliant apologetical arguments pound them into rhetorical dirt. He says let your good deeds shine before men.
Live it.
Live it, exactly. And so that's always the first and most important thing. Now, something when people are open and they don't feel threatened, another thing that is very helpful, but this really has to emerge from their interiority. Like, they have to really be open to this. And it's what happened to me, is when people are confronted with observations about their own tradition and its inconsistencies. So for me, I was raised a Presbyterian and was very dogmatically attached to the Presbyterian Reformed tradition. And through my extensive study of that tradition, I began to find points of difficulty where, well, that doesn't make sense. Well, this doesn't make sense. Well, that doesn't make sense. And I actually lost faith in Presbyterianism before I profess faith in Catholicism. And there was a period of no man's land there where I'd said, okay, well, you know, the Protestant tradition is not true. I came to that conviction. But I wasn't yet ready to pull the trigger to be Catholic.
And that was a very painful
period.
That was
very difficult. It was an extremely difficult period in my life. But you know, I would not have become Catholic had I not previously come to the conviction that my Protestantism was false. Right? Now, people can come to that disillusionment in a lot of different ways. Like me, they could come to that through scholarship, right? There is a woman named Megan Phelps Roper who used to belong to the Westboro Baptist Church, you know, this very fundamentalist and harsh, you know, sectarian group that thinks they're the only people in the world who are right. And she tells in her autobiography the story of how she got detached from that tradition. And it was because she became vulnerable to people of goodwill who asked her genuine, open-ended questions about her own faith that she couldn't answer. And when she began to realize she'd never contemplated the possibility that there were could be any flaws in her belief system, and when she finally confronted that reality, but was it was elicited in a sort of non-threatening way, the pieces began to unravel, eventually she was ready to move on to something else. Now, she didn't become a Catholic. In fact, she left Christianity altogether. But that unraveling has to be part of it.
Sure.
You don't just join Catholicism because Catholicism is neat if you are persuaded that Lutheranism is true, right? So it's kind of a piece. Now, to do that, it's a hard conversation to have if they don't want to have it. Because if you start, then you're going to come across as browbeating and proselytizing and I'm trying to tear down your religion. And we don't want to do that. That's not the mode we want to be in. But if they get to the point where they're like, look, I don't want to have an argument. I want to have what Socrates would call dialectic. Dialectic is not argument. Dialectic is you and I take different sides of an issue because we're mutually seeking the truth together. And it's not threatening, it's we're looking for the truth. We're striving together towards something greater and higher than ourselves, and it's collaborative and it's cooperative, right? An argument is, I'm going to beat you, right? But when a person comes to you and says, look, I'm genuinely in the search for truth mode, and I'm open to challenges to my tradition, let's talk about this. Tell me how you see this issue, because I really want to understand. And why you think my position is wrong, well, that now we can get someplace. Now we can get someplace. Now, for me, I think the key issue, and for Lutherans more than anybody else, is Luther's doctrine of justification. I mean, ultimately, that is the line in the sand. Now, there was a document that came out late 80s, early 90s, called the Joint Declaration on Justification between the Catholic Church and the Lutheran Church. And a lot of people read that document the wrong way. The document says, here are all the things we agree on. Yay! It totally does not address, here are all the things we still disagree on. And because it's upbeat in tone, some people walked away with the false idea that, oh, well, Lutherans and Catholics totally agree on justification. No, they don't. They do not. Okay? And the differences matter. And for me, as a Reformed Christian, what ultimately made me Catholic was realizing that the Catholic Church had the better side of that argument. So educate yourself on the doctrine of justification in what it means to a Lutheran, what it means to a Catholic. Really dig into the exegesis because they're big about the Bible. They're big about Romans and Galatians, St. Paul. Listen to some of the older shows that we've done here. We've unpacked that distinction a lot. Read some books like maybe Alistair McGrath's History of the Doctrine of Justification. The Anglican writer N.T. Wright, his book on justification, he's a Protestant, but he does not hold the Protestant doctrine, right? These are all good, or maybe his book, What St. Paul Really Said. Get your head wrapped around that, and maybe that might be a good place to start. Why don't you sit with your Lutheran friend and say, hey, let's read this Anglican scholar on St. Paul together. Let's read St. Paul, What He Really Said by N.T. Wright, and then maybe move on to Wright's discussion of justification, and we'll go from there.
Ryan, thanks so much. We hope that's helpful for you and for your friend. Thanks so much for your call. Call to communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Donna in Houston, listening on the Great Guadalupe Radio, AM 1430. Hey there, Donna. What's on your mind today?
Hello.
Hi, Donna.
Hi. Thank you. I just have a quick question regarding the conversation about an old church versus new church. How would one know they're going to... Which one?
Oh, yeah, thanks. So, locating the Catholic Church is really not very difficult, right? You're in Houston, Texas. Who's the Archbishop of Houston right now? I can't think.
Oh, you're killing me.
All right, well, you probably know Donna. Who's the Archbishop of Houston?
Do you know Donna?
I should know.
That doesn't matter. Well, I mean, if you just, look up Catholic Church in the proverbial and now non-existent phone book, and find the chancery offices of the diocese, and then they usually give you a list of what all the Catholic parishes are that are in the diocese, and if yours is on that list, you're good, And when you go to Mass, do they remember the Pope in the Mass? Do they pray for the Pope and the bishops?
Is there a picture of the Pope in the
vestibule? Yeah, they have a picture of the Pope. I mean, do they pray for Pope Leo and for your bishop?
Yep, those are pretty good clues for you there, Donna. Thanks so much for your call. Let's go quickly to Dean. Dean is a first-time caller from Illinois, also listening on Covenant Radio. Hey, Dean, what's on your mind today? Dean in Illinois, are you?
My call.
Hey, go right ahead.
Well, as a 33-year convert myself, I appreciate your show. I learn something new every time I listen. But as I'm sure Dr. Andrews can relate, when you convert, the people you leave behind sometimes debate with you. And I have a very healthy debate with my brother for many years. And the one area I don't feel like I stand up too well is eschatology. And I wonder if you had any recommendations of any books or lectures I could listen to. And the second part of my question, I think you've already answered, Dr. Andrews, is what convinced you that it was time to leave where you were and go? But I think you've already addressed that with the previous caller. So
yeah,
I thank you for that.
Thanks. Actually, I didn't. I told you what made me start the process, not what finished it. And I'll get to that in a second. So here's one for you. How about Father Wade Menendez's The Four Last Things, A Catechetical Guide to Death, Judgment, Hell, and Heaven?
Great, great book.
So that's a good one on Catholic eschatology. Now, in terms of what finally sealed the deal for me, so what started the process for me was when I realized that the Catholic doctrine of justification was biblical and historical and rational, and the Protestant doctrine of justification was unbiblical, ahistorical, and quite frankly, horrific, and from a rational point of view, because it implicates injustice of God. And that was a big problem for me, and it started my investigations, and it led me down a path where I kind of systematically subjected all of my Protestant doctrines to scrutiny and found that many of them failed the test, the historical, biblical, rational test, and Catholicism kept looking better and better. But I eventually got to a point where Catholicism was attractive, and I knew that Protestantism wasn't true, but being attractive doesn't make a thing true. Right? I didn't know if Catholicism was true or not. And I'm stuck in a no-man's land of waiting to have a kind of absolute certainty before I would pull the trigger. And what finally decided me for Catholicism were about three things that fell together. One was I read St. Thomas Aquinas, his treatise on truth, De Veritate, and I got my head wrapped around the concept of faith from a Catholic point of view. And I realized that to have faith as a Catholic does not mean that I have absolute rational certainty. That was a mind-blowing realization, that I'm sitting here and waiting for absolute rational certainty. It ain't ever going to come. All right, faith is a willed commitment, the will commanding the intellect to assent to things that it cannot know in principle to be true on the basis of authority and for eschatological hope and other reasons. So I went, okay, that doesn't make me have certainty, but it reframes the nature of the problem. Am I willing to commit myself to this tradition? Because it seems more or less good, true, and beautiful, even though there are going to be some you know, sort of hazy points in the corner.
Yeah.
Secondly, I had been languishing in ecclesiastical limbo and morally was languishing because I didn't have a tradition behind me to support me. I had young children at the time, and my wife, who did not want me to be a Catholic but did not want me to be a wormy little couch potato either, looked at me and said, look, I don't want you to be Catholic, but you'd better go ahead and become Catholic, because you're not doing anybody any good in this no man's land that you're in. Mm. And so that kind of encouraged me. And then I went to see a Catholic priest about becoming Catholic, and he was completely not interested in helping me. And I went to a second Catholic priest about becoming Catholic, and he told me he was thinking of leaving the church, or had thought it, so he wasn't very helpful to me. And then I went to a third Catholic priest and said, I'm thinking of becoming a Catholic. And he said, great, how about next Sunday?
So you had to play Goldilocks and the three priests.
Exactly. So he laid it out for me and made me make a decision. He's like, we'll pencil you in. It'll be November the 16th. Here, go listen to these tapes. There, I've instructed you. I'll receive you into a church. What are you waiting for?
Wow.
And I was like, you know, this priest is going to make me make a decision. He's laid it out for me on a golden platter. And I made a decision at that point that I might never have the kind of deductive certainty that I was looking for, but that I was certain of one thing, and that is that I would rather live in the world as a Catholic than otherwise.
And the world is better for it, for you having crossed the tide.
Well, let's hope so.
Absolutely. Dean, thanks so much for your call. Appreciate that. Call to Communion here on EWTN. We're going to try to get to as many calls as we can in the final moments here. Had the opportunity to listen to Take Two with Jerry and Debbie today. It's on at noon Eastern. You may have heard it. Great show today. It was all about, it was the monthly unscripted show where the listeners decide what exactly they want to talk about. I thought it was a great show. You can check it out tonight at midnight Eastern right here on EWTN Radio. Do check out Take Two with Jerry and Debbie, or if you wish, go to Podcast Central, EWTN.com/podcasts. All right, let's go to Ben now, a first-time caller in Ohio, listening on WEOL. Hello, Ben. What's on your mind today, sir?
Yeah, thank you for having me, Pastor. I was mentioning the screener that I'm a cradle Catholic, and so is my wife, but we were married only the justice of the peace. And when I was going to some of these Protestant churches, and one of the friends made me realize that the way they pass the communion there, it seems so, you know, it's a holy communion. They made that so common. So I want to go to Catholic Church. I want to get communion. And they told me that I'm not married because I was not married in the church.
Yeah, thanks. But I really appreciate the question. Let me ask you a couple of things. Were either you or your wife previously married to someone else before you married one another?
No.
Okay, then that is great. If this is your first marriage and this is her first marriage, this is very easy to fix, okay? You need to contact the priest at your parish. Explain to him that you have just learned that your marriage in front of the justice of the peace is not valid, and I'll explain why that's the case in a second. And could you please have your marriage convalidated? You want to come back to the church and back to communion, you need to have your marriage convalidated. And what you'll do is you'll make an appointment, and you and your wife can go into the Catholic Church. You restate your wedding vows in the presence of a Catholic priest, and boom, now you're validly married. You can go to communion. Easy peasy. No problems. Sometimes people in your situation call me, and perhaps the wife isn't so keen on doing that. Maybe she says, well, I don't really want to go in front of a Catholic priest. There is a workaround, and I won't get into that here, but that's not the end of the road. If that happens, you call me back, and I'll tell you what to do. The reason that's the case is that because you guys are baptized, I assume you're baptized at least, maybe your wife is, you belong to the church, like you're part of the church, right? And the church has jurisdiction over the lives of her members. And if you're both baptized, your marriage is potentially a sacrament. Sacraments belong to the church, just like a priest is not going to go get ordained, you know, on a cruise ship. He's going to get ordained in the cathedral. Christians are going to get married in the church in front of a priest. It highlights the ecclesial nature of the union, right? Because it's really part of the church's constitution, marriage. So they ask us to marry in the church in front of a priest. You didn't know that, so you're innocent. You didn't do anything wrong because you didn't know your obligation, right? But now you do, so it's easy to fix. So go get it fixed, and you go back to communion.
There you go. Ben, thanks so much for your call today. Let's go to Gary, listening on the Great Annunciation Radio in Northwest Ohio. Hello, Gary. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hi. I was recently in a discussion about, there were women deacons in the early church. It says so here in the Bible. Why can't we have women deacons now?
Yeah.
Part of me says, well, those deacons had different responsibilities than they do now.
Yeah, I really appreciate the question. So it's not just that they had different responsibilities. That's true. All right, that's true. So the classic text here would be Romans 16:1, where Paul says, I commend to you our sister Phoebe, a deacon of the church. Okay, and so people go, aha, see, Phoebe, that's a woman. We got a deacon there. But what they don't realize is that the underlying Greek word diakonon, before it means the office of a deacon, it just means servant. It just means servant.
Okay.
Right? Phoebe, a servant of the church. In this context of Romans chapter 16, it doesn't refer to an ecclesiastical office.
Okay.
Now, the 13 letters ascribed to St. Paul, some of them are, but seven of those, all scholars think the historical Paul actually wrote. The others are disputed. Some scholars think Paul wrote them. Some scholars think that Paul didn't write them. I'm not going to get into that question right now, but I'll make a point. One of the reasons there's a dispute about whether that's really all Pauline authorship is the letters that are understood to be later, whether they're Pauline or not, have a developed ecclesiology. That is to say, they have a concept of well-developed church offices that is lacking in the earlier Pauline letters. So there's, whether Paul wrote it or not, there's a development over the course of the Pauline corpus in how solidly Paul describes existing church offices. One of those offices is a deacon. All right, so later in the New Testament, you do find the word deacon used to describe an ordained office in the church. Earlier in Paul's letters, you see the same word used, but it's not describing an office in the church. It's just describing a function, right? Of course, there were women who were outstanding in their service to the church. That doesn't mean they participated in the first grade of holy orders, which is the diaconate.
Right. Exactly. Thanks so much for your call, Gary. Let's go to Jacqueline, listening in Washington on the great Core Christi radio. Hey there, Jacqueline. What's on your mind today?
Hello. I was calling because I am in the process of becoming a member of the Catholic Church, and I have four small children. And I just wanted to ask, what are some things I should focus on in helping to properly form my children? I'm coming from Baptist Protestantism, where I've observed many parents using fear, shame, guilt, and condemnation in trying to get their kids to do what they say and things like that. And I've been teaching my children about the saints. We're going through OCIA, but I just wanted your all's advice on how I can lovingly attract my children to not just me, but to the faith.
What a great question. I really appreciate this question. So it does go back to theology, but also goes to good common human sense. You know, in the Protestant model, God may be Father, but He's also a character who is sort of required by His nature to be wrathful. And the whole idea of atonement is that God must, out of justice, punish somebody for sin. It's going to be Jesus. He's going to punish Jesus, and He pours out His wrath on him and so forth. It's very authoritarian in the way they construe this. And the Catholic Church sees God fundamentally as love, right? And that our reconciliation to Him doesn't come at the price of vicarious punishment, but at reconciliation, that our hearts are melted and changed, and so we're able to kind of resonate on God's divine wavelength of love. So it's us who are changed, you know, not God's attitude so much that has changed, that we're able to come in more communion with Him. And I think we can reflect that different view of God in the way we parent. And, you know, one of the things that a lot of sort of modern psychological literature on parenting has shown, and I think a lot of common basic sense too, is that, like, if you have small kids, your kid has a tantrum and a meltdown. I was raised in a tradition that said, well, you know, the way you handle that is you show them who's boss, you know, and you kind of come in with an authoritarian approach, and maybe you spank them or something like that, and you know, whip them and shape them and get them in line. And you know, that may or may not work in the short run, but in the long time, it leaves the child kind of traumatized and alienated and lacking self-confidence. And the long-term research on that shows that those kinds of kids are fearful and more prone to addiction and depression and ADHD and problems in school and so forth. So we don't want to do that, right? What you can do instead, kid has a meltdown, right? You walk over to the kid, you get down to the kid's level. You kneel down, you get your eyes down to there or below. You give him a great big hug and you say, you know, I know you really wanted, you know, to stay on the slide. I would too, man. The slide is a great place to be. But, you know, mama's got to go back home to make dinner for everybody else. But here's what we'll do. Why don't we, you know, I promise you we'll come back to the slide tomorrow. Or maybe when we get home, I'll let you make a slide out of the cushions on the couch.
Ooh.
Right? So you're still being an authority.
Yeah.
Right? But you're doing it in a way that respects the child's feelings, their dignity. You're offering alternatives, and what you're doing in that is you're doing something that the authoritarian parent does not do. The authoritarian parent is not teaching the child how to handle their own negative emotions and to think about others. They're teaching them to be paranoid and shove those emotions down. The compassionate parent is actually helping the child learn how to calm down and get control of themselves in the context of a relationship where they know they're secure and they're safe. The fundamental message I got as a Protestant kid was, you're not okay and you're not safe. You're broken, you're totally depraved, and therefore the threat of eternal punishment by a wrathful God is hanging over your head at all time, right? And And we want to communicate, you're okay, and you're safe, and I love you, and I've got you, and God has you.
Absolutely.
And you can do that in your parenting style.
Yes, you can. Jacqueline, thanks so much for your call. I really wanted to get to Joe in Fort Murray, New Jersey, and Michael in Granite City, Illinois. Unfortunately, we're all out of time, so please, gentlemen, if you would call us back next week, we'll put you at the head of the line. Dr. David Anders, have a great weekend.
Oh, thank you so much.
Hey, we hope everybody has a great weekend. I believe you're going to Fargo to speak to the great people there.
I'm going to Jackson, Michigan.
Yes.
Good Shepherd Catholic Radio.
Great.
And then I'm going to Real Presence in Fargo.
No rest for you, buddy.
So this is Catholic Radio weekend for me.
But you will be on the air on Monday, God willing.
We will, from Fargo.
From Fargo.
Yeah.
Fantastic. On behalf of our great team, I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders. Thank you for joining us. You have that great weekend. We'll see you in here Monday on the Monday edition of Call to Communion. Till then, have a great one. God bless.